Lyceum exists to cultivate a culture of faithful Christian presence in and around the academy through prayer, practice, and conversation in the hallway, in the classroom, and in the sanctuary. Through the praying of the hours, through schedules of unhurried and ponderous discussion, through practices tied to the rhythms of the church year, and through invited guests, we are reformed as faithful members of and witnesses to the truth of God's presence and activity in the world and in our hearts. These Lyceum podcast conversations are intended to be a digital extension of this larger embodied vision. And today we'll speak with the 9th annual Lyceum Project guest, Leah Labresco Sargent, about her conversion from atheism to Catholicism, about her books, and about her work on her Substack, Other Feminisms. Recently, Leah's writing often appears in Comment, Plow, and First Things. After graduating from Yale in 2011 and converting to Catholicism in 2012, Leah's worked as, among other things, a journalist, a freelance writer, the HR lead for a remittance company, and a curriculum developer for the Center for Applied Rationality. She currently works as a senior policy analyst at the Niskanen Center and runs a highly commendable Substack, as I mentioned, called Other Feminisms. She's the author of two books, Arriving at Amen, about how she learned to pray, and Building the Benedict Option, which is an eminently practical guide to building thick Christian community. Leah Labresco Sargent, welcome to Lyceum Conversations.
Thank you so much for having me.
I thought we'd start with our traditional question, which is, in spite of the somewhat lengthy introduction I gave you, who is Leah Labresco Sargent?
I think the most core thing is that I'm a beloved child of God, but I didn't know that the whole time at the time. I'd say that I'm someone who likes taking things apart and seeing how they work, and hopefully you stick to an attitude of wonder in doing that. So I've held a lot of jobs, as you've mentioned, and I think often what unites those relatively different jobs of working in banking regulation policy, working in chaplaincy, working as a data journalist, working as an HR lead, is there's something cool that I get to see that everyone else inexplicably doesn't find cool, like what are the provisions of a normal consumer checking account, and doesn't want to sit with for as long as I necessarily want to sit with making an enormous spreadsheet of all of the features and looking at the medians of different fees. But once I put it together, it is interesting. And I like being a bridge between that raw or intimidating data and something that is beautiful or actionable or urgent, but doesn't seem so in its original form.
One of the things about being a teacher at a school that runs pre-3 through 12th grade is you see kind of slowly the development of a student and their personality across time and how it expands and grows and changes and sort of stays stable in certain ways. I wonder, where did your desire to kind of take apart and understand things come from? Was that a big emphasis in the home that you were in, or did it kind of come up later? And what's the story on that interest?
Well, my parents are both college professors, and they're very intellectually curious people themselves. And I think they have a real sense of rooting their joy and their love for each other in the exploration of ideas. So, you know, my parents would get the newspaper and then just be reading different sections and pausing and reading things aloud to each other, even when someone else had already seen that section, because if it was really good, you wanted to read it aloud anyway. And so I think I really benefited from seeing that example of the intellectual life being a lively social conversational life. And then, you know, by the time I was in even elementary school, I was taking apart my pen under my desk where my teacher couldn't see, because I wanted to know what was going on. I wanted to see, if I take this piece out, what part fails, right? And I hope, and it's not always the case, that what's going on over my desk with the teacher officially is like that, where you get to engage with real curiosity with what's in front of you and to say, if I change this, what happens? If I poke this part, what happens next? And I have kind of varied in whether I got teachers who were amenable to that or whether that was kind of an extracurricular activity I was doing on the side.
One of the things that you write a fair amount about is the role debate plays in your conversion to Christianity once you were in Yale Political Union. When did your involvement with that kind of debate or competitive debate start? Was it at Yale in particular, or was it beforehand?
It was pretty much at Yale. I don't think my school had a debate team particularly. I think some of the urges people have of arguing semi-collaboratively, semi-competitively came out a little through Model UN, which I did do and traveled a little for. But we didn't have a very intense Model UN. We'd go to other schools and find people who this was their whole life and we didn't mesh well with them. So I think it was really when I went to college, and a little before that, I went to a summer program called CTY, where, you know, it's for nerds who want to take more classes in the summer with other people who want to do that. And there again, it's not that we were doing debate per se, but that our explorations were collaborative and curious in a way that mirrored what I'd do later in debate, of people who just overlapping speech, big enthusiasm, oh, let me go find the thing that supports my idea, not to crush you with it, but because it's cool or it's beautiful or it solves the problem you don't realize you're having, and having that be a joyful collaborative thing.
So describe Yale Political Union, which you joined as a freshman, a little bit. How does it differ from other kinds of formal debate organizations, and what did that difference mean for you?
I usually describe what I did as a philosophical debating circle, just to strongly differentiate it from competitive debate. Yale also had a competitive debate team, and there was very little overlap between the two groups. And part of that's because the form of debate was so different. So in our group, you only argue things you actually believe. It's not the different skill being developed by competitive debate, where you have a randomly chosen side, and the question is, how well can you construct an argument? How good is your rhetoric? How strongly can you piece this together? And so instead, we were arguing just things we thought were really true. You shouldn't bring to bear any argument you don't actually find convincing, even if in a competitive environment, kind of amassing arguments increases things your opponent has to deal with. In our society, that's not helpful to you or to them. If you don't think it's true, no one should waste their time on refuting it. And we also didn't have prizes or judges. So in competitive debate, especially because these are kind of brief, intense clashes, you know, everyone agrees on kind of a standard for what does it mean to debate well. You have judges who are listening for, did you answer the questions raised? Did you address objections put to you? And they can kind of score those in a rubric and say, this team won. We don't have any of that. We don't even have teams. So a debate goes on, it starts at the beginning of the night, and then there's alternating speeches on either side, but very little coordination among the sides. And you may have people who are both on the same side of an issue, but for very different reasons. You get the sense of, well, these two speakers in the F, you know, they both want me to nationalize the curriculum, but not for the same reasons. And they don't like each other. And you don't want that to sound like that's what's going on your debate team. So you can't award victory to a side, per se, or even to an individual. The victory is, I argued for something I think is true. You heard me. You realized I was right. And now you're going to live your whole life differently because you changed your mind. So it's a more lasting trophy, but you can't put it on a shelf.
One of the things I've read about your experience in Yale Political Union is not just that there's no real kind of scorekeeping and you kind of keep score in sort of lives won to your particular side, but also that there's a certain value that community places on being won over, not just winning somebody else over. So talk about kind of the distinction that YPU put on those things and the emphasis they did as well.
When people stood for leadership in our debate group, the expectation was that one of the questions you should be able to answer is, where have you changed your mind since you were a freshman? But it's possible that there's a freshman who's enrolled at some point who was right about everything, slightly by chance. But, you know, the odds that you'd be right about everything, not just a big question like, is God real or not, but everything, like what distinguishes good literature from bad, right? Is so remote that if you can't find something where someone else in the group genuinely changed your mind and you did something differently as a result, it just doesn't sound like you've engaged with debate very seriously. Because one of the things I like is that when you're only arguing for things you actually believe, you feel a lot more exposed giving a speech. It's not just a position of power as when you are defending a side you don't believe in, and you're kind of reveling in your own rhetoric or skill or deftness. And if you slip up, it's a small slip up. But in our debate, if you wind up feeling exposed, if you get a question you can't answer about something you really think, you've got a lot more on the line than am I racking up points for my side. It's, do I need to do something differently? Like, is this a strong point against me that I'm going to really sit with, or is it a glancing blow that I can shrug off? Do I need to amend my life?
One of the books that we read with freshmen at Midtown is Plato's Republic, which famously in book one of the things what you're saying reminds me of is it features this kind of second half of book one. There's 10 books in Plato's Republic, features a dialogue between a character named Thrasymachus and Socrates. And one of the things that Socrates is really adamant about when he's speaking to Thrasymachus is that he needs Thrasymachus to say what he really thinks in order for what he's doing to be effective in any kind of way. And the great failure of book one and the reason why there's 9 more books afterwards, what we always talk to students about is that Thrasymachus at a certain point stops meaningfully participating in that dialogue, and that you need then the other interlocutors, Plato's brothers Glaucon and Adeimantus, to kind of pick that up and really bring themselves to the conversation in order for that conversation to take hold. Is there something influencing YPU to practice that particular form? Is it an older style of debate and more fundamental, like we see it in Plato's Republic, or is it sort of unique to Yale in particular? Where does that come from?
I think it has progenitors in England in the debating societies, though. Without having been to them, I think we do it better at this point. I think just there's an odd thing, whereas the Oxford and Cambridge unions are so clearly vehicles for political advancement in the actual British government, that it becomes a little weird, a little too high stakes. And even though the YPU has produced various people who do hold political office or who became SCOTUS clerks or anything, it's still pretty weird. You know, people who are ambitious and only ambitious at Yale pick something else to do, because there are cheaper ways to move towards prestige. And the YPU does a good job, you know, having its own internal sense of prestige, I think, without becoming so broadly prestigious that people participated in it for the wrong reasons. And it's a little strange or off-putting, which again, I think is also fruitful. So, you know, why did I join when I could do different things? I heard people just do what I thought college was for, which is engage serious topics seriously, sustained conversation, not, well, we're done with this reading for the week, so now we move on to the next text. And it also does something that I think is actually pretty hard to get at a university, which was integrating different parts of I hesitate to even say curricula, because of course a university doesn't have a curricula. Classes have curricula. Departments have people who belong to them. There feels like there's very little coordination between them. So the only place I could really take my linear algebra theory class and try and set it in dialogue with my democratic rhetoric class was at the YPU, because everywhere else things existed in intellectual bubbles. And it was only at a debate floor where it was as reasonable to bring up a scientific study as a novel to expound why you came to believe what you did, that I saw this as part of one work.
There's a late Catholic educator named John Senior who worked at something called the Integrated Humanities Program for several years in Kansas. And he talks a lot about this idea of integration. And one of the assertions that I make in Lyceum on a regular basis, influenced by Senior, is that conversation is what you're describing, is the kind of point of integration between all of these otherwise somewhat disparate disciplines, that you become the point of integration in your earnest conversation with others.
And I love John Senior's work, and I feel this intense kinship with him because, you know, he ran the Integrated Humanities Program. It wasn't purely curricular in the narrow sense, because part of what they thought they needed to do was not just teach students the great books, but they need to teach them how to live. So if you only read the books but didn't also go stargazing, it wasn't enough. If you only read the books but didn't also do social dance, it wasn't enough, right? It's a whole person activity. And our debate group was a lot like that, because we had our formal debates. We had a lot of conversation and socializing that happened outside it. We would read Shakespeare once a week, just read a play out loud, sometimes on a roof, unbeknownst to Yale and definitely not countenanced by them. And like John Senior's Integrated Humanities program, our debate group, even though it wasn't an explicitly Catholic group, and in fact, if the Catholic chaplaincy had any indication of being, you know, linked to us, they would have disavowed us immediately, right? There was a certain amount of undergraduate boisterousness that an official campus group couldn't possibly sustain. But like Singer's Project, we produced a lot of Catholic conversions, and Singer's Project was ultimately shut down by his school because it said, you're up to something.
Right? Yes.
Like, there's something wrong. If so many people become Catholic and even become priests, you must be doing something sneaky.
Yeah. I think Peter Kreef's explanation for why HP was shut down was, what does he say? He said something like overwhelming success.
Yes. And the school held an investigation is the funny thing. And they, you know, decided upon investigating that the professors were not doing anything they weren't allowed to. They weren't evangelizing. They weren't browbeating the students. They weren't even saying, everyone here should be Catholic. You know, they were known to be Catholic. They were up to discuss their faith when students asked. But, and I find this to be a big point in Catholicism's favor, you can have these different groups, the Integrated Humanities Program, the YPU, where they're not founded as evangelical groups. They're just founded to pursue the truth in an integrated way. And weirdly, they keep making Catholics, which I find very encouraging.
And you've touched on that a little bit, but that is a major part of your story. So help us understand, how is what YPU does so connected to this, your conversion to faith, and then sort of faith more generally?
I think one of the things I really valued about it is everyone is asking the question, how should I live? And how should I sort through these different programs of living or claims about how to know what's true? And for me, I came into college as an atheist. I wasn't particularly impressed with Christianity. So I kind of had two big things that I was doing in that context. One, I was meeting smart Christians, which was totally new to me. I'd grown up in a relatively non-religious community. And so to meet someone who was a math major who had then converted to Eastern Orthodoxy was weird. And I knew I had to know something about this. I didn't believe he was right, but I just thought, what's happening over here? And the other thing is, you know, unlike kind of strains of the new atheism, which I think were about clearing space for atheists, I think it came out of a sense of being under threat from Christians, and the goal is just to push them back so that there's breathing room. I'd grown up with that breathing room the whole time, so it wasn't so much that I wanted to refute Christians for the sake of making them go away. I wanted to argue with them because I wanted them to stop being Christians and start being some other specific positive thing. I didn't want to convert my friends just to atheism, which isn't a philosophy in itself. In my case, I wanted to convert them to being Stoics with a strong interest in deontology. You know, and you don't see a lot of people going door to door for that, like Jehovah's Witnesses. Like, hello, can I interest you in the locus of control? You see that a little more now. There's kind of a weird, somewhat corporatized Stoicism industry.
Yeah, there's a resurgence. I was in a bookstore the other day, and there were three or four books just sitting out on a table in various places on different writings of different Stoic philosophers.
And I'll tell you, I'm not that impressed by them for the most part. But at least they're saying the point is to live by something, to check what you should live by. And so in these debates, it was never just that I was examining or rejecting Christian ideas. I was always checking, what am I bringing to the table to invite people into? Is it strong enough? Is it true enough? Is there a big gap somewhere I need to patch?
And Catholicism became a component of that conversation, largely as a consequence of the people involved in YPU.
Mm-hmm.
But then so you tell this story a little bit in your book, Arriving at Amen, which is your first book, and you talk about a long conversation you had with a Lutheran. So why not a Lutheran? Why a Catholic?
Mostly because he was there. This was at a point where I'd gotten to a point where I felt like Catholicism was coherent but false. It held together well. It was consistent. I'd moved past the youthful atheism of just thinking Christianity was too dumb or too incoherent to get purchase on. And I thought Catholicism was almost like a well-written fantasy novel where you're like, well, I could imagine a world where that was true and it would hold together. It would be interesting to live in. It just happens to be fictional. And I had my atheism, which had nothing in it I had any reason to doubt, but had some patchy parts where it wasn't a firm foundation to build on. And I was 19, 20, 21, right? So that sense of I'm working on this project and it isn't complete or tidy or fully filled in wasn't in itself a problem. I wanted to keep working on it. That's what the project of philosophy is. But I'd run into this persistent problem where one thing I believe very strongly is that morality is real. It's as real as the physical world, even if I can't as easily articulate how I perceive it as I can articulate, well, I see the world by looking at it, I feel the world by touching it. After all, there are limits to how well I can follow that explanation. I know a little about the lenses of the eye and the retina, but I don't say that I know enough about it to say, yes, my sense that the world is real comes from my deep understanding of the anatomy of the eye. Absolutely not. My sense that the world is real comes prior to my explorations of the eye. And that's how I felt about morality. The question of whether something is right or wrong is a question that has a real answer in the same way as, are we speaking into mics or not on this podcast? It has a true answer that you can get right or wrong. That relates something external to me that goes beyond my desires or my hopes or my imagination. And that was really where I was stuck, was that articulation of, I believe morality is real, but I have trouble articulating how I have knowledge of something transcendent. And Ben was there. Ben, my Lutheran friend who wanted to be a Lutheran priest, was there at the time when I most wanted to talk about this. And I figured someone who wants to be a priest has signed up to just have people say, here's a problem I have. Come talk to me about it.
Your first book uses a lot of examples from your interest in and your study of mathematics and statistics and game theory. It's one of the things that makes your book so kind of different and interesting as an exploration of prayer, right? So Arriving at Amen is subtitled something like Seven Catholic Prayers Even I Can Pray. Help me understand both your interest in math and then also some of the connections you see between the study of math and your move toward morality and kind of Christian truth as the foundation for that belief.
Math is very beautiful and it's very big. And I found both those things inviting, where, you know, math is fairly inexhaustible. It's something you can keep walking deeper and deeper to in any particular direction. And I really loved, in reading histories of mathematics and working on proofs in Mathletes, just that mix of the abstract and the tangible. Right. So a lot of the math I loved best were things like fractal geometry, topology, stuff that's a little more physically inflected, but then you lose contact with the physical world kind of quickly. It's like, all right, well, let's think about how I can deform this sphere, except it's a four-dimensional sphere, and you're constantly struggling for purchase on something that's almost too large to be pictured. I liked that very much as a challenge. A book I love is called Flatland, and it's about the experience of a two-dimensional square being visited by a sphere in its two-dimensional world. And so for the square, you know, it can't see a sphere. It can see a range of sizes of circle as it passes through the plane of its world. And I think part of it is that kind of challenge of there are things to think about that are almost too big to think about. And math is a way of training yourself to think about something larger than you can encompass yourself.
So I've heard about Flatland. It's actually from Brittany Noble, who's a math teacher here at the school. Tell us a little bit more about it. As I understand it, Flatland is not simply a kind of imaginative exploration of mathematics, but it's also almost a kind of, well, you can correct my misunderstanding here, but like a proto-feminist work to a certain extent. Aren't there, not really? So my understanding was there were kind of there were female characters were two-dimensional, but then the male characters were three-dimensional or something like that.
The female characters are one-dimensional, technically. They're okay. Line segments.
Yes.
And the male characters are shapes. And there's some discussion of relations between the sexes. And, you know, women can be essentially invisible to men by facing them point on. And they're just like a tiny thing. I don't think the book has something very interesting to say about gender.
Okay.
It says some wacky things, but not interesting things to me. To me, what's interesting is that challenge of how do you think about something that's larger than yourself, where the square is trying to understand, you know, not just what the sphere is telling it about a three-dimensional world, but just that a sphere could be. And there's a philosopher, and I've forgotten who it is, who talks about hyper-objects in our world of things that are too large to easily be encompassed within a human life or human cognition. He talks about, you know, global climate change as being one of those things that happens over too large an area and too large a span of time to actually be able to picture very well. What am I trying to grapple with? I think, you know, theology is very much one of those things too, that when we talk about God, we struggle for language. We struggle for, oh, well, I want to talk about the Trinity, and it's sort of like this, but I've quickly stumbled into heresy again whenever I try and take this very large, beautiful, active thing and try and say, well, it's a little like the three phases of water, but it's not that. And it's a little like, you know, this triangle diagram I've made, but it's not that. And you get this tradition of apophatic theology where people say, look, sometimes we really struggle with how to talk about God. So it's easier to say God is not finite and know what we mean by that since we have experience with the finite. And to say God is infinite, we can say it as a kind of string of words, but we don't know what infinite is. We don't have purchase on it. I think that's a similar skill to mathematics where it's saying like, I'm trying to articulate what's true, but I'm articulating true things that I don't touch, you know, and I've got to kind of say like, this is an 11-dimensional sphere, which is like a sphere, but in 11 dimensions, which is a lot. And I can talk about some of its properties or some of its relations or some of its analogies without quite feeling like I capture or control the whole thing. And I think that's also helpful. I think that's something that's neglected a lot in math education, which is we look a lot for that feeling of mastery. I've completely encompassed this. And that's just not actually on the table for some subjects. You know, you can learn enough math to have a meaningful dialogue with math or even make breakthroughs with math without saying, I totally understand this. And I think there's a tendency to water God down or limit him in ways that are false when we try and make theology something where we feel like, now I've got it. Now I understand how God can be infinitely just and infinitely merciful at the same time. I've got it now. And you're like, is that really? You've got it now? Versus I want a sense of that largeness and my smallness in relation to it without having to have the temptation to lie about how large it actually is.
So one of the specific examples you use in the book, and we don't have to talk about this one, we can talk about a different one. You have a chapter on the mass where you use this kind of extended analogy of a coordinate plane. Do you recall this? How does that work? Help us out.
So I think one of the things that I like is that you can think about, I don't know if you ever did that little computer program logo with the turtle when you were growing up. I liked this. It's a little introduction to programming, but where you've got a little turtle that just, if you just think about it as a turtle that has like a pen strapped to its tail. So wherever it goes, it leaves a little trail. And you can direct it to walk around the coordinate plane and it's moving through space and time. But what you just see is the record of the trace of its path. So wherever it crosses itself, there's a little intersection. It can occupy the same spot. You could think about making those spots more and more saturated with ink. And it's kind of fun to think about, you know, if you're a nerd, think about me as a little turtle with a pen strapped to my back, and that as I go through my life, there are moments that are, you know, here I am at X, Y, and this point again and again, X, you know, here I am, Y, here I am, T at this time. But these points all lie together, right? So I go out of my house, I cross the threshold of my door, I come into my house, another little blob of ink, and it kind of builds up the stack of this density of my presence, even though, of course, I'm only there at one particular instant. And the thing that really struck me about the mass is, you know, you can think about this being this additional coordinate there. I'm here at this particular latitude and longitude at this church at this time. But you can think about one other little variable, which is like, am I standing in the presence of Jesus Christ in the Eucharist right now? And there's a point in the mass where I am. And in the same way, you can say like, well, I can think about all the places that have in common that they're at the exact same point in the coordinate plane, that x, y. I can think about kind of the flat space of all the points t, this exact moment everywhere on Earth, all the latitudes and longitude just at this second, the snapshot. But I can also think about that last thing, you know, am I with Jesus right now, bodily in the Eucharist? And I can think about that intersection of, in the same way, I have some kind of weird relation to every me that passes through my door, past and future. We all occupy that same point in space, just at different times. The mass is the moment when I am closest to everyone in the whole history and future of the church on earth, because we are all in that last coordinate part, that in the presence of God, yes or no, bodily in the Eucharist. And to me, it's just kind of arresting, right? You think about the density of that ink blot there, of all those people clustered there, you know, at different X's, different Y's, different T's, but the same presence. And that there are people who I've not yet met, right? Like including my own children, not yet born, who will be at that spot in that sense, in the presence of God, and who lie close to me now because the Mass is the inbreaking of the infinite into the finite, right? And, you know, like a lot of ways of talking about God, saying like, well, it's kind of like being on a coordinate plane where there's one special plane called, is Jesus here in the Eucharist or not? Like, it's a very limited analogy for talking about something so large, but it's one that captures me and, you know, gives me that little joyful spark thinking about the largeness of it, because it's hard to think about the largeness of the body of Christ in us, you know, facing him in his body in the Eucharist.
There's a novel that I read a couple of years ago by one of the Inklings named Charles Williams. I don't know if you're familiar at all with his work.
I read one of his. He's the very weird Inkling.
He's the very weird Inkling. And he's got a novel called The Descent into Hell. It's mm-hmm. one of his sort of series of, I think they're called, like spiritual shockers or something like that. And in that particular novel, there's a character who sees her doppelganger at various points in the novel and is very kind of freaked out by this, and is the distant descendant of a martyr who died on the same hill where they all live, sort of several hundred years before. And there's I'm going to spoil this book for anybody who reads it, so I apologize in advance if you want to just edit this out. That's fine in your own listening. But there's a moment in time when that doppelganger and that character converge as a component of a vision that the martyr has before his martyrdom, kind of at the same place and in a different point in time, sort of in the future, and where those kind of presences come together, which strikes me as a little bit similar to what you're talking about in a kind of modern Williamsy way.
And I think the fun thing about some of those, you know, wilder ways of framing this, and I think even I, in my heights of mathematical exuberance, don't remotely approach Charles Williams's, you know, flights of fancy, is that, you know, again, we're trying to talk about something very large and very arresting and not bring it all the way down to earth or make it too normal or too comprehensible. And part of what I like about my analogy is it's just, you know, which is most real? Like, is it where I am physically or is it where I am in relation to God? Most of the time we treat my physical, you know, motion through the world as the most real description of where I am. But it's pretty reasonable to say, like, the most relevant thing is not what building am I in, but who am I with? And I like the way that the coordinate analogy puts those on the same plane, as it were.
So you're probably best known as the writer of books for your second book rather than your first one, mm-hmm. the book on building the Benedict Option. That's not a book strictly speaking about the practice of prayer, about your own conversion, but more about a practical guide to forming Christian community in particular places. How did you come to write that book, and what do you think people need to know about forming Christian community well in particular places?
I think part of it came out of just a series of conversations I was having and other people were having that centered on a book and first a blog that an Eastern Orthodox writer, Rod Dreher, was leading about the Benedict Option, as he called it. And he was really rooting that language in the way that the Benedictines in the Dark Ages preserved the Christian faith and preserved a culture of learning, but they didn't just preserve it for themselves behind their walls. These men who made a strong, radical, countercultural choice for God attracted villages around their monasteries where what they had spilled out over into the world, and people came to them to live slightly more ordinary lives, but lives that were rooted in what the monks were doing. And the way I frame it, and what I like best about different constructions or framing out the Benedict Option, is, you know, in order to engage the world well, we have to be deeply rooted in God. You can think about being kind of a channel or a pipe that has to be open at both ends. If you're active in the world, engaging the world, and you don't have that other end of the pipe open, you don't have something to offer the world. So my goal in my book is, what can you do in the next 2 weeks or 2 months, wherever you are right now, to be more deeply rooted in God and more connected to the community around you?
So what can I do in the next 2 weeks to be more connected to the community around me? Are there some practical steps that I can start taking right now to cultivate the kind of community that you're envisioning?
The smallest one I recommend is just, I try really to have the habit that when I'm with Christian friends, I don't part from them without praying with them in person. And I think there can be a tendency to get together as Christians and talk about Christianity or talk about a text or talk about, and this was probably the least productive current events in the church. And so in some sense, we're having a Christian dialogue that whole time. And you can even say like, oh, you know, and will you pray? I've got, you know, this appointment coming up. I'll go, yeah, I'll pray about that at home later. And I think it's a shame. You know, I want to make sure that when I get together with Christian friends, we pray together right then. And so the simplest thing usually for me, especially in a ecumenical group, is just, you know, asking everyone for their intentions and then praying an Our Father together. And the funny thing is that when I do that, I often find that I'll spend an hour or two with someone and talked about a lot of things in our life. And it's not until I say, is there anything we should pray for right now together, that I hear whatever has been most important to them over the last week or most on their mind, that just didn't feel like it belonged in ordinary conversation to say, my mother has to go back for another mammogram after there was a shadow on the first one, and that doesn't feel like it is a natural entry point into the conversation until there's the question of what should we pray for together. And I think that's often, when I think about that Ben-Op shift, it's about how can my friendships, including my existing friendships with Christians, be more rooted in Christ? And that's the smallest shift, is don't part from each other without praying together.
So I also want to talk about your Substack, Other Feminisms. But before we get there, it strikes me that your work now and your work for the past several years in various ways is closely related to kind of where you live and to Congress and to this sort of thinking about policy and politics. And I'm just curious, as a person that doesn't live in D.C. and isn't that knowledgeable about kind of current events in that area, do you have a way that you think people misunderstand or misconstrue kind of the D.C. and the government there that needs to be corrected? And then how would you advise people that don't live in that space and work in that area to think well about what's going on there?
You know, I think there's a lot of well-intentioned people, and more people than you'd think, including people who seem pretty powerful, feel stuck a lot of the time. Where whether I'm talking to a congressional staffer, you know, who likes their boss, but, you know, is like, well, you know, my boss has already ticked off this committee chair enough that we can't do anything else. It's going to it. We've like burned through our goodwill there. Or, you know, so it's just like, oh, well, we're not doing anything else for the next like 4 weeks. You're like, you're not doing anything else. We're not doing anything else. But when I first had a job that was kind of interfaced with Congress and was on banking policy, we had a government relations person. And it just felt like I was always talking to a weird pagan priest, where it was like, he'd come back and like, yes, you know, and he wouldn't say, I've read the entrails, but it sounded like the kind of sentence you could preface with, I've read the entrails, like, Congress is very uncertain right now. We will not approach them until they are less, you know, giddy or skittish. And I'm like, okay. It's like, now is an auspicious time to talk to them about overdraft fees. I've read the entrails. Everything felt like that. So I think there's just a lot more uncertainty and people feeling pretty limited in the power they apply, and a lot of coordination problems of, are there enough people to vote for any particular thing? If they all just did vote on it together right now and no one could see them, yes, sometimes. Like, do they all agree that this is the thing they're going to prioritize? No. You know, so I think the other thing that's kind of surprising is I thought more as a young person of lobbying as something you do to change people's mind. And that happens sometimes, but a lot of times it's much more about finding allies and getting them to move what you do up their list of priorities, where you're not taking someone who's opposed to a policy and convincing them or bribing them to switch their view. It's about, you're probably only going to do three things this term. Like, is this one of the three things?
So one of the things I think that people might criticize to a certain extent is the kind of growth of maybe like hyper-partisan activity, and then also the the kind of what feels or gets communicated as being kind of stagnation. So like Congress isn't doing anything, and also there's this kind of hyper-partisanship that's developing there. And but the way that you talk about it, it sounds a little bit different than that to me. So are you just wildly optimistic, or is there reasons kind of to think more positively and not as negatively about Congress at the moment?
I think there's kind of a frustrating paradox where people sometimes talk about secret Congress as the main place where things get done. And they're not, it's not literally secret. There have been wackier secret Congress proposals, like what if Congress had 1 month where they could vote on things, but none of the votes were recorded by name. And then everyone who thought something was good, but their voters would punish them for doing it, just voted for it, and then it passed, right? And you expect some things would pass there that wouldn't pass in an open session. And that's, you know, not a sign of health, right? If Congress people have things they think genuinely are good, would serve their voters well, but they can't make the case to their own voters for their vote. But the other part of secret Congress is just a lot of fruitful things happen when there's less public attention on Congress, in part because if you approach politics as a very zero-sum way, you know, anything that passes with bipartisan support is kind of suspect. Did we give too much away? Did they pull one over on us? And things that pass in a very quiet way with very little coverage have more room for progress to happen as long as no one celebrates it or praises it. And that's a little depressing. You know, you want people who have passed good policies to feel proud of them, go back to their district, run on this basis. And I think a lot of the times, Congress people don't feel like they have the room to talk about the things they're proudest of doing because they're not confident they'll be celebrated for them.
So as a person that's not involved explicitly and doesn't live near that area, what is there something I should do? What should be my approach to this issue?
No, I think it's hard to be informed about everything that's happening at once. So one of the things I think is always good is to get pretty involved in local politics as a start or a primary channel of energy where you have the most capacity to check up on what's happening, to meet the people you're voting for, and to exercise a real check or encouragement for them. And you have a lot more power there. And then kind of as you develop that sense of what are the trade-offs? How do I make the distinction between someone who says, well, you know, we can never get everything and means it and is genuinely fighting for what they can get, and someone who's using that as an excuse for inaction? I think it's easier to sharpen that sense at the local level and then try and apply it back up to the higher and more abstract level. You know, there's a stay-at-home mom in my neighborhood who's just been aggressively going through our neighborhood's budget and audit, and you know, has found a lot of things that are pretty inconsistent. You know, and she's one person just like reading through publicly available documents and sending them questions. And now they've pulled all the budget information off the website, and it's not clear if they're actually doing crimes or just very messy. Mm. But she just has a lot of capacity to be a real check and, you know, encouragement. I don't think that's how they think of her, right? Mm-hmm. But she's doing it because she cares about the neighborhood. So I think people often find that if you practice at the lower level, you'll gain a lot of the prudence you need for the higher level.
Is this something that Christians especially ought to be doing in your way of thinking? Like Christians ought to be engaged pretty highly in local level politics, especially?
Yes, and I think in a generous and curious way, especially if you're getting started. Don't start with the assumption, I bet there's a financial crime going on that I'm going to ferret out, that possibly that's what she's doing. I keep waiting for more emails from her to find out what's happening next. But just with the real sense of this is a community I'm called to be a steward of. I have to know more about it to be a steward. Start with that question and then see where you want to throw what weight you have around.
One of the questions that my students and I talk a fair amount about in omnibus classes, especially in our ancient history and literature class, is the question of power and Christianity's relationship to it. And we talk a fair amount about, you know, the development of democracy in classical Greece and then sort of the Roman governance of the world and its political system, and then we always kind of try to critique that with Christ's instantiation of divine power in the world and this kind of acceptance of kenosis as this fundamental element, and that's comparable in some ways to Socrates and So I wonder if you have any thoughts on that and its role to play in kind of Christians' involvement in politics. This is too large a question to ask you to give any sort of huge answer to, but what would you say is the relationship between sort of Christian thought and action in the world and then power or powerlessness and the kind of proper Christian position there?
You know, I like the language of stewardship because it implies that we're custodians of something we're asked to administer justly that isn't ours. So when Christians find themselves in a powerful position because of your personal wealth, your stance in the community, a privilege you have, it's important to remember that those are given to you to deal out justly, but not as a mark of your own goodness and not as something that is yours in a deep sense, right? Our wealth is for us to spend or dispense in alms. Like our personal following is, you know, for us to think about directing past us to Christ. And there's a real reason that there are particularly strong warnings given to those who, by leading others, lead them into sin. That sin weighs more heavily on someone who leads or teaches others erroneously than it does on the person who in good faith learns from them. So I think Christians should think about power as something that's intimidating, right? Like something we have a real duty to wield. We don't want to be like the servant who buries the talent because they're so frightened of spending it badly that they just hide it and run from it. But not ours, and something that exposes us to danger as well as gives us power to do good.
So the last part of our conversation, we'll talk about other feminisms, the Substack that you started a couple of years ago. I wonder if you might start by just explaining the title mm-hmm. of the Substack. So it's called Other Feminisms. What do you mean by other feminisms? And are there multiple feminisms? And what's wrong with the one? And
there are a bunch of
going
them, right?
on there.
Because I think people start with that question of what is feminism? And I think one of the briefest, you know, descriptions or definitions is it's the belief that women are people. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone agrees with that one, or like women should be treated fairly. And then the disputes about feminism come down to what does fairness consist of? What is a person? And the reason I like the title Other Feminisms is that there are some parts of mainstream feminism that I don't agree with, you know, like the strong support for abortion as critical to women's rights. But it's not that I reject the project of feminism, it's that I see it as a lively dialogue or dispute about what does it mean to be attentive to justice for women. And I'm offering an alternate answer. When I started the Substack, I came up with a couple other titles, but they were all terrible, that were kind of riffs on first, second, or third wave feminism. And I pitched my husband, I'm like, what if I call it undertow feminism? And he's like, it's terrible. Don't do it. So I wound up with this more generic answer. But I'd say the heart of what I'm putting forward is, I think the error that's kind of common within mainstream feminism is that for women to be equal to men, you know, recognized as equal to men. I think mainstream feminists and I both start with the presumption women are equal in dignity to men. That for them to be equal, we have to be interchangeable with men. And so anything that marks women out as distinctive is in some sense a problem to be solved. And so fertility, the vulnerability that pregnancy imposes, is something that puts women behind men. And helping women means erasing that difference. Solving it, blotting it out, killing anyone who stands in the way. And my argument is, if you premise women's equality on interchangeability with men, first of all, you're never going to get there. You can get kind of closer, but you can't actually close that gap because men and women are different. But also then you're basically saying women are defective men, that the project of feminism is ameliorating those deficiencies. And I think then that can't be a woman-centered project. That's a project of making it up to women that were women.
You wrote an essay in Comment as kind of part of this project called Designing Woman. And toward the conclusion of that essay, you write that the task of mothers and of us all is to demand that the world be restored so it welcomes us all as we are. How does one go about doing that? And also, why do you say in particular that that's the task of mothers and of us all?
You know, I think we live in a world that says something false about the human person, that the basic human person is autonomous. They don't need things from other people, not things they can't buy in the marketplace. And their life is not deeply shaped by other people's need for them. And that's not true of men or women, but it's a lie that's a little more spacious for men. Men can live within it comfortably for longer before running up against a point where the lie really limits them. And for women, it's obvious that's untrue. Even a woman who's desperately trying to avoid pregnancy is avoiding it because she knows that if she becomes pregnant, she will not be autonomous. She will care for someone who is dependent on her. That dependency will render her dependent on others. She won't be a human in this very limited sense that we talk about humans as lone, independent individuals. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of the lucky thing, you know, you can frame this in two ways, right? And sometimes mainstream feminism frames this as a tough thing for women. Women have trouble existing in the world as it is, agreed, right? Like a world that asks unjust things will hurt women more because this unjust demand to be autonomous pinches us harder, faster, more cruelly. Hmm. On the other hand, there's an enormous freedom in saying, wow, living within this lie is never going to be an option for me. You know, I can't assent to it. I can't pretend it's true. I have to offer resistance to it. And now the question is what form that resistance will take.
For another essay that you wrote in Plow, relatedly, you write that you're sort of critiquing a kind of dominant theory of gender, and you write that this theory of gender is just an update, an expansion of what women have been hearing for years, that our bodies and ourselves are the problem, that when there's a mismatch between us and our society's expectation, it's we who have to change. I wonder if you might unpack that kind of critique a little bit. What are you thinking about in that essay, Let the Body Testify for Plow, and how does that kind of allow you to have what sounds to me like a kind of feminist critique of a theory of gender?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of ways in which a woman's body winds up being unwelcome in the world or is asked to be fixed. You know, and I think that starts for a lot of women. Their first experience of that is having the default assumption be that they go on the pill, right? Where it's just, well, like a natural woman's body is a dangerous body. It's too hospitable to life. There's something wrong that what women should be is infertile by default, and there's something wrong with the baseline woman, but we can fix that for you, right? I think some women kind of get steered in that direction for the reasons of avoiding pregnancy. For other cases, it's even just the problem of having a real issue with your cycle, some with PCOS, with endometriosis, where a doctor, instead of being curious about the cause, just goes, your cycles are irregular. Maybe something's wrong, but we can make them look regular. Mm. We'll fix the appearance, not the underlying hormonal problem. And that's kind of one branch of we can fix your body so that it looks more normal without in any way accommodating you or fixing a real, you know, medical issue. And then as you go on, you run into, you know, the tech company. It's like, well, you know, obviously family is important to people. So we're happy to offer egg freezing. You know, to remind you, you don't have to have kids now. Like, that would be really inconvenient for us. So we hope that you'll think about your future by not having it at the moment. Thanks. You know, where again, the natural progression of life is the problem. Then we can fix it, make it better, push it away. And the example I talk about a bit in that comment piece is the example of breast pumps. And I want to be clear, I don't think there's something intrinsically wrong with them. But I think we ask the question of, like, who does this serve? Whose needs are this designed for? And a lot of the time, you know, breast pumps are kind of marketed as a way of better accommodating your boss rather than better accommodating your baby. Hmm. And again, I don't think there's anything wrong, especially when people face kind of limited options and want to figure out what's best for their family. But if you think about it, you know, the breast pump lets you push the baby further away. And there are things that are obviously unjust if the baby were there that the pump lets pass as reasonable. So a lot of women find they don't have a safe place to pump at work or are asked to wait an unreasonably long time to pump when they physically need to do it on a certain schedule. Or the boss is like, can't you just go in the supply closet? You know, and if the baby were there instead of the machine, it'd be much more obvious that the baby has to nurse right now because the baby isn't afraid of your boss. The baby's going to just scream mm-hmm. right now. And mm-hmm. I talk in the little in the essay about this being like a paraphasic, yeah. prophetic speech. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look, we take a lot of things where someone, especially a child who's unashamed of what's true, gets pushed further away so we don't have to hear that cry.
You go on in the essay, Let the Body Testify, to say, an alternative to expressive individualism is something like, and then your quote is, valuing the givenness of our bodies as they are in all their vulnerability. And weakness. How is this, what you're putting forward, an alternative to expressive individualism? Maybe we should also talk about what expressive individualism is in the first place. But
yes, I think expressive individualism is the idea that what is chosen is what's most valuable about us. Things that we author ourselves are what make us who we are, and everything that's given or received is kind of more suspect. And that's where you get that sense of, you know, the default, the natural human body is, you know, the raw material, but it's what you do with it that counts. And, you know, I think that's in its grasp for a partial truth, right? We're given certain capacities. I talked about stewardship. We're called to develop them, extend them, apply them. But you wind up with this kind of intense suspicion of the given, such that it feels more you to turn off your body than to cherish it or accommodate it. It's more empowered to, you know, find a way to distance yourself from your baby than to be at your baby's beck and call, which makes it sound like you're your baby's servant, right? Like, isn't that worse? Versus, no, my life as a mom is shaped by my baby's needs. Like, I have different things I do. I've done sleep training, so it's not as though my baby gets to decide everything in my house forever. You know, part of my job as a parent is offering a no to a baby so they can learn. But I want to be shaped by the people around me. I don't want everything to be voluntary or chosen or on my own terms.
In one of the essays we've already talked about, the Designing Woman essay, you, when you're writing about breast pumps, you talk about tools and try to outline a kind of more helpful way of thinking about them. The quote I have is, the tools we use must not be designed from a perspective of contempt for our creation or our creator. I wonder if you have a kind of you don't, even in the essay Designing Woman, you're not kind of critiquing technology, but a lot of what you say seems related to technological development and technological progress and its direction. Is there something that you've written somewhere else, or is there something yet to be written about that kind of larger question of how we think about technological progress if we're going to take seriously our kind of givenness that you're talking about?
There's an author I really admire named Sarah Hendren, who writes on disability and design and has a book called What Can a Body Do that I think speaks well to this, because I think she explores the ways that people who are disabled often kind of face two kinds of help they can get, one that's less helpful than others. And there's a kind of help that's about passing for a normal-bodied person, whether or not that fits you well. And then there's a kind of help that's about meeting your particular body where it is. And she gives the example of a woman who's very short, who has a form of dwarfism, who's usually offered various increasingly large step stools to get up to a podium. And she, you know, talks to Sarah's design class, and she just wants help building a collapsible podium she can take with her on trips that is sized to her. Hmm. So she's not balancing on anything. And she occupies a different space than the normal space, which she's okay with doing, that's proportional to her, rather than kind of teetering over the edge of something. I think that kind of help is sometimes viewed as unwelcome. It's like, well, aren't we drawing attention to your difference? Isn't the best thing we can do helping you pass as normal? There's another woman who has a limb difference, and she has a very impressive, very technological bionic hand that's harder for her to use than, you know, the kind of limited but real physical hand she has. And so it's kind of a trade-off for her of, does she want to use this hand that does a better job looking like the hand people expect? Or does she do what she actually does, which she attaches zip ties to a lot of drawers in her house? And the zip tie is something she can grasp and pull with the fingers she has, rather than putting on something to look more like a normal person and interact with it the exact same way. And I see, again, that real parallel to, are women being asked to do a better job fitting into a male mold, regardless of how uncomfortable or how much of an encumbrance it is? Or are we told, you know what, like, we're happy to work with you to have tools that fit your body as it is, a podium that's actually your height, not just a step stool up to the male height or the normal bodied height, you know, a handle pull that suits your hand as it is, especially in your own house, rather than a good way of aping having the hand you don't actually have.
I think there's a tendency, as you say, partially to think that what needs to happen is that difference needs to be ignored, mm-hmm. or that that difference needs to be kind of recognized as difference and sort of compensated for. It is connected to your kind of critique more generally of this sort of enlightenment vision of the self as autonomous, mm-hmm. and it does seem like there's an assumption that normal equals autonomous male in this sort of particular season. What do we do with that category of normal? Should we eschew it completely? Like, okay, well, there's no such thing as normal, actually, in the end. Is that the correct sort of response? And is that like what you're saying? Or is there a better way of thinking about it?
I think it's helpful to think about common versus normal. Okay. You know, this is a common way. We don't customize everything, right? You know, it's something the Army has thought about a lot, interestingly, because they have to recruit people from within a band of things they'll fit, but then think about, okay, well, what is the bottom 5% to the upper 95% of sizes we're accommodating? How do we plan for and anticipate them? I think it's helpful to think about how we build things that have some flex in the system, right? So it's not just we have a very narrow mold of human being we expect to be here, especially I think it's how we design work and something where COVID gave a little room for people to reset their assumptions. So instead of saying all work is from 9 to 5, it's in person, it looks like this, going like, well, what's a little bit of flex of what that could look like? And not just now we have 2 schedules, right? But like, how do we make room for accommodating different people and their particularity and trying to be attentive to what's fair for everyone, but also curious about what will work best for individuals, thinking of a world of individuals, not just aggregates. And then I think for Christians, especially thinking, God has done something good in creating each person. So when I run into someone who offers a lot of friction to our way of doing things, what here is a gift for me of seeing what God has done in making them?
Well, some people listening to the podcast will have gone to the Lyceum Project this evening, which you're about to give. Mm-hmm. Some people won't have. I wonder if you could give us kind of a short version of what it will be this evening and what people might want to go find on the YouTube channel or something.
I'd say at the core, what I'm here to talk about is what does it mean to be human? And that when we live in a society that has a false idea of what it means to be human, autonomous, individual, independent, not only does that place a very heavy burden on women who know that that will never be fully true of us, and secretly it's never fully true of men either, but they can skate by for longer before that's obvious, it really distorts our relationship with God, because our relationship with God is not one of an independent equal here to bargain on equal terms. And if we despise dependence in each other here on earth, we don't know how to stand before our Father in heaven.
Well, Leah, we're looking forward to the Lyceum Project lecture this evening. Thank you for coming on the podcast and talking to us about your work. And may you, wherever you listen, be a participant in rich and life-giving conversation.